Welcome, listeners, to another episode of What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the latest resolutions in the world of high school debate. This episode comes with a bit of a warning ahead of it because it does involve mature themes. This is an interview with Calvin College Professor of Philosophy, Dr. Michael Watson, and in this interview he discusses a bit more sensitive topics than we typically discuss on this show. So, if you are a middle schooler listening to this show, you should pause the show and double check with your parents that they are willing to let you listen to it. In this show, we do discuss abortion and we do discuss intimate relations to a certain extent. There's no particularly graphic conversation, though there are a couple jokes, and there are references to a bit more private and personal decisions than we typically get into on What's the Res. This is in the context of investigating a philosophical paradigm, but please listen to the episode knowing that it does have slightly more mature themes than we typically get into. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a special edition of What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. My name is Josh Herring. I'm a debate coach and humanities instructor at Thales Academy in Rollsville, North Carolina. As you may know from listening to the last two Lincoln Douglas mini-episodes, I'm currently at a conference in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and today I am joined by conference faculty member Dr. Michael Watson. Dr. Watson is an associate professor of political science at Calvin College here in Grand Rapids, and he has graciously consented to lend us his expertise in natural law thinking. Dr. Watson, welcome to What's the Res.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
I'm so excited for how for what you can share with us today. Before we get there, I should mention that Dr. Watson is the author of several books. One in particular that I do want to mention from 2016 is called C.S. Lewis on Politics and the Natural Law. He co-authored that with Justin Dyer. And Dr. Watson, are you currently working on any other book projects that are worth mentioning
so
here?
In the interest of full disclosure, that's pretty much the only book that I've really authored. I have chapters in edited books, so I tend to do smaller things. I have a couple little things I'm working on right now, chapter-wise, one on civil religion. I tend to write something bigger every few years, but right now I'm more on the working on singles and doubles and no home runs.
Sure. Oh, well, that's those certainly have a very important place in furthering conversations. I'm particularly excited that you can join us today because about 2 to 3 years ago, I started running into thinkers who used a philosophical system that I wasn't very familiar with, and they called that natural law. And I started looking into a bit more, and I learned that there were a lot of Catholic thinkers who used natural law. And I went to a summer conference last summer and listened to a professor named Jay Budzewski.
Buzuszewski.
Thank you for correctly pronouncing his name. I knew I was going to butcher it. Could you say it one more time?
It was Jay Buzuszewski.
He was a fabulous teacher. I just, one of those guys, you're like, oh, you've clearly been a professor for 40 years and you know your stuff so well.
Yeah. If you have talked with Jay Buzuszewski, that's the gold standard in terms of expressing ideas, articulating ideas. He's written a book called Written on the Heart, which if you're looking for an introduction to natural law thinking, that would be the one. I've had the privilege of meeting Jay. I know Jay a little bit, and he's a fantastic thinker. So that's a great introduction.
Being able to say I talked with him is probably overstating the case just a little bit. I was one of maybe 120 people who were benefiting from his scholarship, but where I was hoping you could help us today is in terms of thinking about how could natural law work as a way to approach, as a philosophy that could maybe help us articulate a different way of advocating for policy changes. Part of our goal on this show is to equip students to understand the philosophy paradigms that come into play in Lincoln Douglas debate. Mm-hmm. And I think natural law could be that kind of a paradigm, but I suspect it's an unusual one, and some of our listeners may be looking for an unexpected argumentative strategy that's not going to be one of the standard ones, consequentialism or deontology, or maybe a Marxist approach or some kind of critical theory apparatus.
Yeah.
So I suspect they'd really benefit from an introduction to natural law. So with that as background, and knowing that our listeners are probably unfamiliar with the natural law tradition, Dr. Watson, what exactly is the natural law?
Yeah, the natural law is a way of talking about what human beings are at root. What kind of creatures are we? What sorts of lives help us flourish? What does a good human life look like? The idea is that we have a nature that is given. Many natural law thinkers are theists of some kind who think that God authored that nature. You know, one of the most famous sources of a natural law idea or thought is actually in Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham Jail. So many of your students may not be familiar with Thomas Aquinas' natural law theory or Cicero or some of these guys, but they've probably heard of Martin Luther King, and they may have even read the letter from Birmingham Jail.
That's very much, I think that's a very true suspicion there. That's a frequent, the first Lincoln-Douglas debate every year for novice students is all about civil disobedience and whether it's appropriate in a democracy. So Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement is a place where most LD students begin.
Yeah.
So I suspect that's a good starting point.
That's a great entry point then, because if we think about what the occasion of King's writing that letter is, he is frustrated with some clergy who, while agreeing with him that racism is wrong, that the country needs to change, want him to go slower, to be more moderate. And so he writes this letter from the jail cells, a remarkable letter. But in that letter, he is drawn from voices like St. Augustine, St. Thomas. He's talking about right and wrong. And the question he's answering is, how can you say it's okay to break the law? And he says, well, some laws are just laws, and some laws are unjust laws. And if it's an unjust law, then we have the right to disobey. We should still pay the penalty. To go to jail is to actually show respect for the law. And there he quotes Augustine and Aquinas, basically talking about a law that affirms human dignity is a good law. A law that attacks human dignity or degrades it is a bad law. So one way to think about what natural law addresses is it the case that there are some things that human beings can do that rub against the grain of what we're supposed to be? For example, to treat someone poorly because of their race. Is the status of that judgment that doing that is wrong, is that merely coming from what our society tells us? Is it kind of like a something that would evolve such that it could change? Or is it something deeply rooted into the reality of human beings that it's wrong to hold someone else as property, it's wrong to treat someone as deficient because of the color of their skin? And it's wrong no matter what. It's wrong even if society says it's right. It's wrong even if it's a different time. All times and all places. Are there some things like that that are just wrong because of the nature of things? Or is morality more like fashion clothing? It changes and shifts, and who are we to say whether it's right or wrong for one era or another?
And the natural law tradition would be saying, no, there actually are these things that are permanent then.
Absolutely correct, right. Now, how those things might get instantiated in law will vary in terms of punishment, but the natural law tradition will teach that there's a human nature. There are certain things that are good for us as human beings and certain things that are bad, and that the truth of those things does not depend on their popularity.
Interesting. So even in a democracy where the people hold the authority and the sovereignty and they give some of that to their elected representatives, there are still things that are right and wrong that just in and of themselves are right and wrong rather than are right and wrong because people affirm them.
That's right. Think about the Lincoln-Douglas debates. One of the things that they are debating is popular sovereignty in the states. And Douglas, on the issue of slavery, wants to say, I'm not for or against slavery. Let each state decide for themselves if they want to vote it in. And Lincoln's response is, there are some questions that actually predate that vote or come before it. The question of who counts as a human being who gets to vote. You can't have a vote on which human beings get to vote. You have to have that view that comes before him. People can access knowledge about right and wrong even apart from what a religion might say. So Plato, Aristotle, a number of Greek philosophers aren't relying on, say, scriptures to come up with some of the things they think are true about lying, say, or about sexual relations, or about killing the innocent. That we have the capacity as human beings to reason about these things and determine that it's right to honor our parents. One can get that from a revealed scripture, right? As you do in the Jewish scriptures. And one can also reason one's way to that using one the reason that God's given us.
So this natural law tradition really does have a pretty strong view of human reason and our ability to figure these kinds of things out.
Yeah, that's right. And then, and there's a continuum of belief in that. So Thomas Aquinas, for example, is pretty confident that that can be the case. A Protestant thinker like John Calvin still believes the natural law exists, but he's less confident in our reason to figure it out. So you'll have some variance there, but there is a basic belief that human beings are equipped to be able to figure out, to some extent, what's right and wrong.
So, and now, it sounds like part of this also means that approaching this kind of thinking requires us also to figure out what the purpose of things are, and then evaluate use against purpose. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, I think that's right. So the thinker most associated with purpose or telos is Aristotle. Aristotle, we wouldn't necessarily call a natural law thinker, because it's to talk about law usually implies there's a lawgiver of some sort. Right? Mm-hmm. Aristotle doesn't really have it, but he does talk about purpose. And it's only when you understand what a human being is supposed to be that you can understand what gets us from where we are now to that point.
Oh.
And that's where the answer to that is going to be, for him, it's going to be virtues. Virtues are going to help get us to what the kind of life we're supposed to live.
Okay. Well, that is fascinating. Let me pose a different question there. What ethical implications do you see in this kind of approach? If someone was going to try and follow a natural law thinking paradigm or theory, what does that obligate them to certain positions on ethical questions?
I have to think about that. So the natural lawyers have a certain way of thinking about morality, and they have often come to similar conclusions. Which isn't to say they always agree on everything. But they're going to look at the way that our bodies are designed. They're going to look at what we have in common with, you know, all living things, for example, take in sustenance, right? And so in some sense, we have something in common with the plants. We have in common with animals that we reproduce. But what's unique to human beings, of course, is that we have a reason in a way that plants and animals do not. So many natural lawyers, for example, think that the cultivation of our reason is part of what it means to be a flourishing human being. And so they will encourage things like, you know, debate societies, education, to help cultivate our capacity to think about the good life. Most natural law folks will have more traditional views about human sexuality, for example, that there's a certain purpose that's built into sex. That includes like the pleasurable aspects of that, but not just that, but there's a procreative aspect to that. Natural law folks will talk about how to distinguish what kind of actions are different from other kinds of actions. Mm-hmm. They'll investigate the intent of the actor has a great deal of determining power in terms of what the action is. So, for example, if you were to take a sharp knife and cut me down the middle of my chest, we don't know yet whether that's a good or bad action or not. If you're trying to steal my sweet ride, my 2007 Dodge Durango parked outside, right, then that's a bad action because you're assaulting me and you're doing something that leads to a diminishment of human dignity. And if, on the other hand, you're a surgeon and I need an appendectomy, then you're slicing down the middle is a good thing. So natural lawyers will also talk about intention and how that plays a role in our moral behavior and decision making.
So it sounds like this really is a paradigm that doesn't necessarily have a definitive catechism of questions and answers, but is more of a certain way of approaching a question and thinking through an issue in light of tradition and purpose and design and intent, with a preference for really the uniqueness of the human being in being able to reason through this and determine what's the right answer in this moment.
Yeah, so if Jay Buszczyszewski were here, and that'd be great because he would be able to explain this really well. But there are certain principles that are foundational that themselves can't be proven. They're what we start with. So Thomas Aquinas says that the first principle of practical reason, and by that he means moral reasoning, is to do good and avoid evil. Now that's extremely general; doesn't help us. But he will also talk about how you have these secondary principles: do not take the life of an innocent person. Now, one of the things that's just true about moral decision-making is it gets dicier the more specific your situation is.
Okay.
So natural law does not proclaim to be a sort of a casuistry of just this, you're going to plug in the situation and each time get out this factory produced blueprint sort of answer. But the way you put it was I think good. It is an approach that's going to take certain truths and then apply those truths to particular situations and try and figure out what the best thing to do is. So can I go back to Lincoln?
Please do.
Right. So Lincoln believed that slavery was unnatural, that human beings are meant to live freely, and thus for a man to own another man as he would own a hog goes against the grain of our nature, because we are meant to be free and to reason, and hogs are not, according to Lincoln. He's not a PETA fan, right? So
okay.
But the abolitionists agreed with Lincoln on that in his day. The radical abolitionists who also thought that slavery was an affront to human dignity and to God. So they both agree on what natural law teaches, which is that slavery is unnatural and wrong. They disagreed a great deal as to how to accomplish that reality.
Okay.
Lincoln believed he was bound by the Constitution. He had to honor that. He was restricted in his power. And so his attempts to end slavery are more gradual until he gets the Emancipation Proclamation. The abolitionists want to say, to heck with the Constitution. Let's burn it all down and we'll end slavery that way. So you have two people who both agree on the naturalness or the unnaturalness of slavery, but their understanding of what would be the best way to get to that goal differs because they have different prudential judgments about how to accomplish it.
And in both cases, this natural law reasoning led to a very practical kind of argumentation. I know there are several places where Lincoln makes his argument against slavery,
yeah,
and really his thinking eventually culminates in why, even though it doesn't have political power in the sense of actually freeing slaves, he still writes the Emancipation Proclamation in sincerity, believing that that is the right thing for him to do.
Yeah, and he thought that by articulating the principle, it would set in motion what followed, which is eventually that slavery would be abolished. He has a fragment where he's imagining this conversation with himself or with someone who believes in slavery. He says, well, what is it exactly that determines whether someone can be a slave or not? Is it someone's skin is darker than yours? And he said, if so, take care, because the next person you meet whose skin is lighter than yours, he can make you his slave. He says, is it that you're smarter than them? Well, take care. The next time you meet someone who's smarter than you, by that principle, he can make you his slave. Is it that it's in that person's interest to make you his slave? Well, take care. The next person you meet who makes it his interest to enslave you. So that's just logical reasoning, right? And people can see that, that makes sense, right? And that's that capacity we have to use our reason to say, Lincoln there has identified something that's true and fitting about human nature by putting on the witness stand and interrogating the alternative reasons that people would use to defend slavery.
Oh, that's a very helpful quote. It reminds me of one of my favorite 20th century poems that I don't remember the name of the poet, but it's written on the wall at the end of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and it's if I remember correctly, it's a German who wrote this, and he has this parallel structure where he says, first they came for the Jews, and I did not care because I was not a Jew.
Right.
Then they came for the homosexuals, and I did not care because I was not a homosexual. And then they came for the priest, and I did not care because I was not a priest. And lastly, they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me.
Right.
And I think I'm paraphrasing. I don't have it in front of me, so I may have mangled the quotation, but there's something very true about that that really explains our burden to speak on behalf of those who can't always speak for themselves.
Right. Well, in a way, what that, and I think I got pretty close, what that echoes is love your neighbor as yourself.
It does.
You realize, I would not want this to happen to me, therefore I should speak out when it happens to someone else. So it sort of draws on our self-interest as well as what should be our concern for our neighbor.
Those are some very helpful observations. Well, tell me about your interest in natural law theory, because of course you're a Protestant scholar at a Protestant college, possibly soon to be a university.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to be a generally Catholic way of thinking. Am I right about that? And how did you become interested in this as a thought paradigm?
So there is this perception that natural law is a Catholic thing, and my Catholic friends and the Catholic Church certainly has been a champion of natural law, and I am grateful for that, and we Protestants owe a debt to our Catholic friends. I first became interested in natural law because I was a C.S. Lewis fan, And Lewis uses natural law arguments all the time. So one of the first things I read of his was Mere Christianity, which was a set of radio addresses he gave over the BBC during World War II. And he begins with a natural law argument. So I became interested because of that. But the notion that it's just a Catholic thing is true in terms of the perception, but it's not true in terms of the reality.
Mm.
Of all the things that Luther and Calvin and other reformers debated with or about during the Reformation, natural law is not one of them. Both Luther and Calvin affirm the existence of natural law. And it becomes more of a Catholic thing because there are some Protestants, and Karl Barth would be one of the main ones, who see natural law as a sort of a rival to Christian revelation. And whereas the traditional Catholic view, and I think the correct Protestant view, would be that natural law is actually, it's God's design. If I'm talking about natural law from the outside, I say you don't need revelation to make sense of it. If I'm talking about it from the inside as a Christian, I think it's what people can know about how God made us using the reason God gave them. And it's consistent with what God tells us through Scripture. Actually, there's been a bit of a renaissance of Protestant natural law thinking in the last 50 years or so. And even among folks who aren't Protestant or Catholic, World War II, you mentioned the Holocaust Museum, there was a movement in law called legal positivism prior to World War II, which basically wanted to say that each country has its own law, and there's no way you can criticize that from some universal standard like natural law would provide.
Okay.
The problem then, after World War II, you have Nuremberg, and you want to try these Nazi war criminals. Well, if you believe in legal positivism, on what standard are you going to try these folks? Everything they did was legal, according to Germany's judicial system. So people who were positivists in that sense had to rediscover, well, maybe there are some things that are crimes against humanity, right? And it reintroduced this idea that maybe there's some way we can all know about norms. You have Nuremberg, you have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where you have people with lots of coming from lots of different points of view agree on some norms. So I think there's actually been a little bit more of an appreciation for natural law, though it's still controversial. Natural law tends to be conserved in sexual ethics, and people don't like that. And natural law has been misused in the past. There were folks who would use natural law arguments to defend slavery.
Mm.
So it's not as if as with any approach to thinking of morality, the test can't be, has it ever been misused? Because that knocks out everything, right? Everything
right,
can
right.
be misused. But I do think it's enjoyed a little bit more of an appreciation in recent decades.
Mm. As I say, I find that absolutely fascinating because I've seen over 20th century history, I've looked at some of those movements with the creation of the Hague and the International Criminal Court, and at least in the West, and I assume throughout much of the rest of the world as well, there's a pretty reasonable understanding of the idea of crimes against humanity. But when you press, we had a debate resolution a year or two ago that was we were trying to dig into the sources of international law.
Hmm.
And it becomes really, without that kind of universal framework you're describing, it's really hard to explain why exactly any one nation should obey the expectations of another.
Right.
And I have one student who he enjoys arguing from ridiculous premises sometimes, and this may be one of them. I don't know if he was sincere in this, but he at least made the argument that the Germans were legally right to sink the Lusitania. And because by German law, they had issued a pronouncement that any ships that entered their waters would be fired upon by U-boats.
Yeah.
And I tried to make the argument that actually, well, this we can't, we're going to be in really troubling waters at the point where we say that it is right to for a military action to affect women and children and civilians, and that this is a military attack on a civilian vessel. And all of those are complicating factors. I think the natural law paradigm you've outlined would give us a really helpful way to say, well, that's the law in this country and that country, but what is the natural law that every human being is bound by and accountable to in some way, even if it's sometimes tricky to exactly pin that down in
right.
concrete particulars?
Yeah, I mean, your student can be right in this sense. It much depends on what he means by legally right. And if what you mean by legally right is that the declaration fulfilled some procedural requirements for what a law has to be as voted on and declared and that sort of thing, then you can say, yes, that was legally right. But then we were thrust back to Martin Luther King Jr.'s distinction in the letter from Birmingham Jail of unjust laws and just laws. And so legally right might be accurate, but it's really diminished in terms of what it tells us. All it can tell us is that a country is doing something. Whereas we want to know whether or not it's binding or obligatory, or whether it promotes human dignity and the common good or detracts from that. Well, then we're looking at a different sort of moral sort of judgment. And that's where the natural law can come in. One of the things, one of the mistakes we can make is to think that we can sit back and look at these different approaches as if they are options for our lunch. So here's utilitarianism, here's natural law, here's deontology, here's virtue ethics, and here's something else. As if when we're sitting back, the natural law person is going to ask you, what's the criteria you're using to judge between these different options? Natural lawyer claims you're using natural law. Natural law is not one option among many different things. It's actually going to be the ground on which you make any sort of decision, whether you recognize it or not. So we're sort of imperialists in that sense. We think you're going to be using the natural law unless you're a complete moral skeptic, right? In which case, you're going to have some different sort of problems you're going to encounter.
Well, that's really interesting because certainly as a Christian, I would hear that and think that the natural law fits with what the Apostle Paul says in the book of Romans, that the law of God is written on our hearts.
Right.
And so from a Judeo-Christian kind of point of view, could we look at the natural law as part of the natural revelation of God? Not certainly not as full as the fully revealed divine revelation of Scripture, but the beginning points of that, and God showing himself to people through this kind of moral sense that leads them to these particular principles.
Yeah, so here's where Thomas helps us. Thomas talks about the eternal law, which is the way things are in their order as God knows it.
And for our listeners, that is Thomas Aquinas, so everybody's clear.
So the 13th century great figure of the Catholic Church, of course, his at that time, everyone except for the Eastern Orthodox were Catholic.
That's right.
So he talks about eternal law as being that which God knows it, as God knows it. The natural law is that which we can apprehend of God's design using our own reason, like you mentioned, right?
Okay.
And then divine law is that which God gives to us through Scripture. And sometimes it's both. So you can figure out that stealing is wrong, and the Bible says that stealing is wrong, right? So natural law has what we might think of as, to use a fancy philosophical term, an ontological component, which is here's how things are, and then an epistemological, which is how we know things, here's how we know things. How else do we explain some of the things that peoples all across the world throughout history have held in common? Incest appears to be a pretty universal taboo. Well, why is that the case? The natural lawyer would say, the Christian natural lawyer would say, that's part of God's writing in our hearts the way that we're supposed to live and the way that we're not supposed to live. I think the way you put it is right. The natural law is how we can know things. God has designed us this way to know things. Even apart from what he gives us with special revelation. And we actually see that in the Bible. So think about all the prophets, many of the prophets God sends to his own chosen people, but some of the prophets he sends out.
He does. I was just reading this morning about Jeremiah is sent to deliver a message to Moab.
Yeah, to Moab or Jonah, to Nineveh. Mm-hmm. And if the only way we can know right and wrong is from God's special revelation, how are these prophets going to go out and tell people, hey, you've been messing up? Unless they already know internally, because God's written on their heart, there's some things they should and should not do. Right? So there's a whole lot of stuff in Scripture that presupposes that people can know right and wrong, even apart from divine revelation. Jesus says, let your light shine before men that they may know your God in heaven and praise him. Well, how do they know that unless they have some access to the moral law that's built in, even though, you have to add, at least particularly, as I'm a Calvin College professor, it is our hearts are marred by the effects of the fall.
Sure. Now, that's incredibly helpful and just absolutely fascinating to think through. It reminds me of one of my favorite parts in my school's literature curriculums. I've taught our ninth grade literature class for a couple of years, and that part of the sequence begins with the ancient Near East, and by the end of the year, we're through Greek tragedy. And one of my favorite of the tragedians is the Greek poet Sophocles. Well, I was actually going to go one prior to that.
Okay.
Antigone does the same. I think you could easily make a similar point with Antigone. And that actually fits as probably a better parallel to the Martin Luther King letter you mentioned. But I've taught that class two or three times now. And it's always fascinating to me when we reach Oedipus Rex and Because, of course, that book is it's a bit of a murder mystery.
Yeah.
And the question of who did it is revealed, and I'm not going to give away the turn there for any listeners who haven't read this yet.
Okay. No spoilers.
No spoilers. We'll try. But the turn there is so gripping because Sophocles reaches right to the core of that moral sensibility.
Right.
And say, where I don't think anyone can read Oedipus for the first time without this, like, ugh, how gross sense.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And that sort of response points back, I think, to this universal reality that we know some things are right and some things are wrong because of the nature of who we are and how we come to be.
Yeah, and it's hard to discuss that without saying what the twist is. But I guess what I want to make one caution there, which is the validity of the natural law, we can see evidence of it, but you might find a culture that seems blind to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, for example, of the very popular HBO series Game of Thrones,
sure,
which has elements of that thing you're talking about in Oedipus Rex,
yes,
that some people might be okay with, right? So you wouldn't want to make that the test of it, that we all kind of,
oh sure,
we would be repulsed by it, because sometimes people might be okay with it. Thomas Aquinas mentions, he quotes Julius Caesar, he talks about the Germans. No offense to any Germans out there, but the Germans at that time didn't seem to know that stealing was wrong.
Oh my.
And yet, the natural law teaches that stealing is wrong. So there's a sort of a deadening of our consciences that can happen, and natural law accounts for that. The question is, how do you wake that up? Oedipus Rex works really well. I thought of Antigone, because Antigone has, she has disobeyed an edict from Creon, and when he calls her to account for this, she says, "You didn't write this law. The edict you made violates the laws of the gods and of justice that was there even before the gods began." She appeals to this knowledge she has about right and wrong, and says it's just built into the fabric of reality. It's very much a natural law sort. So Sophocles is a great example, because the wrongness that's happening in Thebes is causing a moral pollution that's affecting the very health of the city.
Let me ask you a different question, and if you don't want to go there, that's fine. We can shift gears, because I really want to pick your brain about any other examples from Lewis's thought as well. But before we get there, this kind of thinking, I know historically, used to be more common. Why is this less common today than it was, say, 300, 400, 500, or 800 years ago, to go all the way back to Aquinas?
Well, that's probably a $1 million question in terms of telling that story. I've in other conversations with you, I've heard you mention Charles Taylor's A Secular Age.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is that the rise of modernity has, in some ways, explained things that we used to attribute to divine forces. So the rise of science has explained some things that people used to say it was this deity or that sort of mystical thing. And I think that people have come to see the world as less enchanted, to use a Taylor term, or less purposeful. And thus, if you think that the world is more random, or that there's not a purpose, it's a number of things that will contribute to this, then you're less likely to, when you look at human nature, to see purpose there as well.
Mm.
Right? So I think there's a connection in how we've demystified some aspects of the natural world, and then when we turn that lens on ourselves, we can demystify that we might be built for a higher purpose. And I suspect part of that comes with a secularity that's rising. I mean, the other aspect of this is true in the West, but I don't know how much true it is in other parts of the world, right? In places where religiosity is actually growing. Natural law belief tends to coincide very nicely, for reasons you wouldn't be surprised by, with religious faith. And because if you believe there's an order to the world, you're likely to believe that there's a nature you should accord with. So I suspect that the secularity of modernity has also contributed to that.
That's helpful. Well, let's shift towards wrapping up, because our interview is getting kind of probably towards about time. But help us with some, you mentioned that this was very formative for C.S. Lewis earlier. Can you give us some examples where natural law thinking shows up in Lewis's thought?
Yeah, well, there's an apologetic function that it plays for him, in that he he asks people to think about a moral law, and he observes that when you listen to people talk, they're often making appeals to some kind of standard. Well, you didn't do this right, or you were unfair to me. People talk as if there's some kind of standard that they can appeal to. And then he asks, well, where does this come from? And he uses that to kick off his argument, leading to why we should believe that there's a God, and in fact that Jesus Christ is God's son. But in other places, he writes about natural law reasoning or uses it. He gives an address in Oxford to the Oxford Pacifist Society called Why I Am Not a Pacifist. And in that talk, he basically lays out how he decides whether anything's right or wrong. And he kind of lays out a natural law sort of approach to figuring out the question of whether or not it is right to bear arms for your state. He writes a book called The Abolition of Man, which is not arguing for natural law, it's arguing against all the alternatives. And that's one of his most philosophically challenging books, but it's really worth working through if you can do it. Because he basically says, if you don't think that these moral truths are built into human nature, then what are you left with? You're left with a human nature that is anchorless, and really anything goes for the most powerful. And what you can object to when you want to object to rape or slavery is, I don't like that. You can't say that goes against the grain of what the world is supposed to be, or that goes against human nature's purpose.
So we really lose the ability to truly condemn an action in the absence of this kind of superstructured framework. And I can't, from what you just said, if I abandon the natural law or abandon a moral orientation that's grounded, I really can't say that rape or murder are wrong. I might be able to say they are bad consequences that harm people in some way, but I can't actually say why those things are bad.
You diminish the depth to which you can describe it, right? So you can say that I don't like it, you can say that it hurts people, but you aren't able to articulate the depth. When we hear about an atrocity, something awful done to a child or an assault, there's something in us that realizes that it's deep. It's not just wrong or off or inefficient, but evil. Right? There's an evil, and that reaction that we have, Lewis would say, I think, points to this reality of a moral law that transcends us. Mm. Not to trivialize it, but in one sense, you think about an anthill that wipes out another anthill, and we think, gosh, that's just ants acting like ants. Well, without the natural law, that's really just a description of genocide, right? One people wiping out another people. How do we account for the moral horror we feel about genocide if there's not something more permanently rooted in who we are and who we're supposed to be? It turns moral judgments into the trivialized, like kind of ice cream flavors. I like vanilla, you like chocolate. I like human rights, you like genocide. There's no real right answer there. It's kind of just different approaches to it.
Now, it's probably a good moment to at least intersect the idea that part of Lincoln-Douglas debate does look at times like that choosing an ice cream flavor, because students are selecting a philosophical approach to help them argue a position that they've been assigned rather than one that they've chosen. But one of the things I teach all of my students and hope to also advocate through this podcast is that it's very important that in the process of debate we don't simply become ultimate relativists, but that by the end of the process, hopefully we've reached one of two positions. Either we have reached an actual conviction that we believe and can articulate why, or we have reached a conviction that neither of the positions that we wrote cases for this game of debate is actually correct. Mm-hmm. And perhaps there's some other deeper reality that we have yet to really understand.
Yeah.
But I think there's a danger inherent in debate, and it's a similar danger, I think, that can happen to those who are good at the game of academia.
Oh, for sure.
Where you learn to research all kinds of things and be very effective at presenting what you've researched. But it's sometimes, I think it's important, as folks listening to this hopefully that we keep tied closely to the pursuit of truth through our argumentation and through our search for philosophy.
Yeah, so if your students ever get into Plato, for example, mm-hmm. You'll find that Plato's Socrates is always battling the sophists. And the sophists are fantastic at the game of debate. And that's useful, right? It's useful to learn how to debate, how to distinguish, how to make your strong cases. But they were known as those who could debate either side, not caring which one is right. And effectively, you're an argumentative prostitute. right? I mean, you're just servicing whomever's paying you. So I think you're exactly right. It's good to learn the tricks of the trade, but at the end of the day, you want to know what's right. And that's why, even if you lose the debate, like you've lost the argument, but you've realized what's true, Socrates and Plato would say you've won. And the hardest thing for us as competitive, either professors or high school students or high school teachers, if we want to win, just like you want to win an athletic contest, but Socrates and Plato would say, and it sounds like, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but you actually win if you have furthered in your knowledge of the truth, even if you've lost the particular debate. So yeah, debate, compete, work hard, enjoy the give and take of it. But please keep it, yeah, like you said, keep it tethered to the notion that you're trying to figure out what's true about the world and about life and about politics and all that stuff.
Which does ultimately keep us tied to the original meaning of the word philosophy as the love of wisdom and seeking to find wisdom. Well, Dr. Watson, help us with a couple contemporary applications. Are there any, I know in our lunch conversation the other day, you mentioned how natural law can give rise to an environmentalist argument. Are there any, could you help us with that, and maybe any other contemporary policy issues that you think really a natural law position speaks to this policy issue in some way?
Sure. When it comes to the environment, I mean, I teach at a Christian college and we train our students, many of our students might study what's good for the environment and how to clean up rivers that need cleaning and how to advocate for policies that will be better, that will take care of the environment better. And our students will go out into the public square and make these arguments for everybody, whether they're Christian or not. As Christians, they will be able to give a particular reason why they believe in it, but they expect that the non-Christian and people of other faiths will also be able to recognize, oh, the environment's important, here's how we take care of it. Well, that's sort of natural law in action, right? It's this belief that we can all access this norm of what would be good and we can take action on it, even though we might have different reasons for it. And so that's, I think that's an evidence, that's evidence there of natural law in action. When it comes to sexual mores, and here we get into much more controversial ground, like what's the purpose of marriage? What's the purpose of the family? I think the natural law has some important things to say there. And even if, in this is such a hot topic in our culture today, people don't agree with that. Even if they don't agree with that, they will find natural law reasoning a good interlocutor to help sharpen their own thinking. Mm. When it comes to these other hot potato topics like end-of-life issues, human cloning, abortion, there's some good natural law arguments about those things. If human beings have intrinsic dignity, at what point should law step in and protect that, right? That's what the abortion debate's all about. What qualities of a human being are there immediately after the human being has left the birth canal that weren't there before? Natural law will press that, or we'll think about those questions and those debates. So it's really any issue of public concern. For Lincoln and Douglas, it was about slavery and about self-determination, democracy. Today, we're talking about immigration. Right? Does someone have a natural right to be able to come to a new country? Does a country have a natural right to determine who gets in and who doesn't? Does poverty, someone who's poor, have a natural right to sustenance? These are the sorts of debates that natural law can speak into, given its kind of foundations.
Well, that's incredibly helpful, and I think our listeners will find a lot of value in thinking through natural law paradigms. You mentioned the professor from Texas, whose name I'm not going to pronounce and butcher again. But are there any other, and of course you mentioned C.S. Lewis and his Abolition of Man and book Mere Christianity. Mm-hmm. Are there any other natural law thinkers that you would recommend to our listeners as introductory, and keeping in mind our high school audience orientation, but that it would be accessible but helpful to them as they try to kind of grasp this thing and see where it's applicable?
Yeah, I do think Jay Buszyszewski's book, Written on the Heart, would be a great introduction, and Jay is just a fantastic thinker. My teacher in graduate school is Robert George at Princeton. Now, Robert George's books are a little denser. Mm-hmm. He does have a book that called A Clash of Orthodoxies, which might be a good resource for students that are feeling like they want to go for it. C.S. Lewis I'm always happy to recommend C.S. Lewis. If you are Catholic, you know, the Catholic Church has some interesting resources on natural law. Thomas Aquinas takes a while to get used to, but you can read Thomas Aquinas. studying with teachers like you, and there are some resources out there on the particular issues. So if you're interested in religious freedom, or if you're interested in poverty, there'll be some books that are that might address those.
Well, that's good to know, because we'll keep an eye out for those based on the resolutions, and certainly as if we find those, I'll probably at least mention them in the relevant episode for that resolution and tag the link in the show notes so the students are aware of that as a resource. Well, Dr. Watson, we're coming towards the end of our time today. I know you're a teacher at Calvin College. My immediate audience is, or my immediate students are in North Carolina, but at least according to Podbean, we have folks in India and Germany and one person from the Netherlands who's listened to our show.
Oh, great.
So presuming a potential global audience of incredibly bright, really smart, debating high school students, should they consider Calvin College for undergrad?
You won't be shocked to respond that yes, yes they should. And if you're from the Netherlands, we have a lot of Dutch folks here in Grand Rapids at Calvin College. But wherever you're from, I actually have students from North Carolina. We draw students from all over. And if you are interested in a school that focuses on the liberal arts, Calvin is rooted in the Christian Reformed tradition. But we have students from all different faiths, and some students of no faith at all. So we are like a public school in that we have a point of view, but we admit it. Whereas a number of public and secular schools will have a point of view, but pretend to be neutral. But yeah, come study with us or give us a look. Come visit. We do have a pretty white winter that will build your character, but the summers and the falls are fantastic, and I actually like winter, even though I'm from California. We tackle the big ideas. We have folks on the left, on the right, up and down, all over. So if the idea of talking about important ideas and learning at a campus where you have lots of other like-minded people and people that differ, I would encourage you to check us out and give us a look. And email me, and I'd be happy to try and talk you into it.
That sounds great, and I will join you in recommending the character qualities of a frigid Michigan winter. I went to Hillsdale College for undergrad, and I'm glad to live in the South, but I do have fond memories of a cold winter, because it means I can wear a t-shirt when it's 32 degrees outside and not feel like it's that cold. I couldn't do that before I came to Michigan. Well, thank you, Dr. Watson, for your time and for helping us understand the natural law tradition. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us today on What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. My guest this episode has been Dr. Michael Watson, Associate Professor of Political Science at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. If you have any questions or feedback, please email us at whatstheres@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at whatstheres_. I look forward to joining you next time for more What's the Res.